You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a production of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is the author of a new book that tells the story of the daily struggles of a rural hospital in northwestern Iowa. But the story is so much bigger than that. And my guest weaves in larger themes that affect us all, and listeners here, I think, on both sides of the river will relate to. He's Brian Alexander, and the book is called The Hospital: Life, Death, and Dollars in a Small American Town. Brian, thank you so much for taking the time to be on today.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
I had you on previously. You wrote a book about the town where you grew up in called Glass House. That was a very interesting book of relevance to our region here as well. I'm curious if that book stimulated the interest in this book in tackling this topic.
Well, in a way it did, because when I was living in and reporting from my old hometown, I learned that the hospital in Lancaster, Ohio, which is where Glass House is set, was now the largest employer in the town, as the town had somewhat deindustrialized. So I did a little research and realized that this was true for many towns all over the Midwest, the parts of the South, parts of inland Atlantic seaboard. Hospitals are now becoming the economic drivers for a lot of towns. But there's a problem with that, I discovered, in that many hundreds of these hospitals are in shaky financial shape. And so what happens to your town if the new economic driver is sketchy financially and they were to close? And in fact, there were, at the time I looked into that, there were about 600 hospitals, mostly community hospitals, at risk of closing in this country. So I began to look into it. I wrote a story for The Atlantic, where I have been a contributing writer. And I interviewed a fellow in Northwest Ohio named Phil Ennen, who ran a small community hospital up there. He called me after the story came out, and he said, you know, if you want to go deeper in this area, you should come visit us and see how we stay open. And so I did, and that led to the book.
How We Stay Open. That's an interesting way of putting that. Before we get deeper into that, where is this at for our listeners who may be curious, the geography? Where's this located, and what are kind of give us kind of a snapshot of the area that you're talking about?
Certainly. This is in Bryan, Ohio. Bryan is the county seat of Williams County, Ohio. It's in the very far northwest corner of the state. It's tucked right underneath Michigan and right up against the Indiana state line. So you're about, 50, in Bryan, you're 15, 20 minutes from Michigan, and you're 15 minutes from Indiana. It was largely agricultural, and a lot of the land area is still agricultural. The county's 421 square miles. But there are many fewer full-time farmers, as farms have consolidated, which I'm sure is true in your area also. And so what the economy really depends on are small-time manufacturers. And largely, their output goes to the auto industry. Detroit is about 90 minutes, give or take, away. Toledo, where Jeeps are made, are 50 miles in to the east. And Fort Wayne, Indiana, which has some auto manufacturing, is about 50 miles to the west. And so you get plastic injection molders, metal stampers, forming companies, tier two auto suppliers. And that's where most of their products go.
Just one more question on this. What's the population of Bryan and then Williams County?
Bryan is roughly 8,500 people, so it's a small town. If you want to extend it just beyond beyond the city limits, you could probably come up with another 1,500, so it's about 10,000 people. In the county of Williams, it's about 36,000 people, give or take.
Okay. Just to give our listeners some idea of what we're talking about here. And you got really interesting access to pretty much everything. The board meetings, got to talk to everybody involved and even be there when patients were coming in.
Yep. It was very rare for any journalist to have this kind of access to a hospital. And so I really wanted to make the most of it. It was a little delicate at the beginning because there was some opposition from the law firm that the hospital uses. But the CEO, Phil Ennen, really believed in the possibility of the project. He felt that community hospitals and especially rural community hospitals were too little known, and what they faced is too little known, and he really wanted to expose that.
Here's how you describe it, and I'm going to paraphrase a little bit here. In many ways, the hospital is a Band-Aid station, though not the kind its detractors implied. It was a battlefield clinic in an amorphous and mutating social and economic war that was killing people. The hospital took in the casualties, patched them up, and released them back, and the one had become a one-sided conflict. That's an interesting way of describing that, and I relate that back to what you said earlier, what Phil told you about how the hospital stays open. This is the reality in many places. I think this is symptomatic of larger hospitals as well, but this place is just struggling to stay alive. How does its status as profit or nonprofit have anything to do with that?
Not really so much that, and you're correct. Writing about this one hospital in one small town really provided me with an avatar for what's going on all over the country. It's really about our nation. It's not just about this one hospital. And as far as profit versus nonprofit, it is a nonprofit community asset, a 501c3. Most hospitals are nonprofits. There are exceptions. There are big for-profit hospital chains, for example. Those operated by Hospital Corporation of America, for example, are for-profit hospitals. As a nonprofit, you don't technically make a profit. You have what's called an operating surplus. But as I detail in the book, as healthcare consolidation advances in our country, you wind up with these gigantic health systems, which are technically nonprofit, but they act just like the for-profits do. And increasingly, the healthcare economy is being dominated by these giant systems, and these small fish like community hospitals and wellness centers in Bryan, Ohio, are really becoming targets, and in some cases being driven out of business by these large outfits.
You talk, I think it's in the introduction, about how every cost is accounted for. And I remember my own experience. A member of my family was in the hospital for an extended period last summer, and they would come in with the little laser guns, and even pills, single pills, would be accounted for with costs. And you talk a lot about healthcare economics that don't really seem to have any relation to normal economics. And the incentives are almost the opposite in a lot of ways.
Yeah, but you know, it's interesting you bring that up, because in the book I argue that we have two parallel economic systems, and both of them are currently bad for most people. People are, you alluded to the battlefield comment, and that the hospital in Bryan is really an aid station in a social and economic battle. The people in Bryan, Ohio, people who are working there, they're often working in low-wage jobs because the economy has changed so much over the past 40 years. So they're making actually less and less money. Increasingly, they are no longer represented by unions, which they used to be represented by. But meanwhile, when they have to encounter this parallel healthcare economy, costs are enormous, It doesn't make sense. Doctors who work in the healthcare economy call it crazy and insane. Insurance brokers call it crazy and insane and, you know, non-sustainable. It's a weird parallel universe that really doesn't jive at all with the real life that most people are living.
And the incentives are almost for a rural hospital, well, really any hospital, isn't so much maybe on prevention, but having more procedures. That's the way it appears anyway, that if you're going to stay economically viable, you got to have lots of services and keep doing lots of things.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the weird thing about American healthcare, and this is true for all American healthcare, healthcare businesses, and we'll call these nonprofit hospitals a business also because they have to operate like a business. That's part of the tension in the book is the business versus the actual mission of the hospital. If you're going to survive, you need people to have heart attacks. You need people to have broken legs and cancers. You need people, unfortunately, to have diabetes. And diabetes is actually quite lucrative because as long as that diabetic lives, they are a constant source of revenue for you. So keeping people healthy doesn't pay you. And that's unfortunate for all of us. It's the weird sort of backwards way that American healthcare works.
Now, I've heard backers of the system, healthcare system, say, and just to kind of put their viewpoint out here, that they have to perhaps charge more for private pay patients because Medicaid, which covers quite a few patients, especially out in rural areas, the reimbursements aren't as high, so they have to make that up somewhere by charging more. And I thought you handled that pretty well, your response in the book.
Well, that's true. So if you're a hospital, you want what's called a payer mix that is weighted in favor of people with private insurance, you know, employer-supplied insurance or Blue Cross, Blue Shield, something like that. You want that. Unfortunately, in many, many towns, it's the opposite. In the town of Bryan, CHWC, the hospital there, two-thirds of its revenue comes from Medicaid and Medicare. The hospital in Lancaster, Ohio, where Glass House was set, my hometown, same thing. Two-thirds comes from Medicaid and Medicare. This is true for many community hospitals all over the Midwest. They really rely on Medicaid and Medicare for that revenue. But they get paid more by the more private insurers. And so if you go in, the contract that they've negotiated with the private insurer is going to pay them more than the one that Medicaid and Medicare are going to pay them. So they really need that money from those private insurers.
And the cost of the same procedure, it can be radically different just within some mile, 50 miles up, apart from these facilities.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There's a famous, egregious case in California, for example, where if you have a heart attack in Northern California, it can cost you $15,000 more than if you had the heart attack in Los Angeles. And the reason for that is market dominance by one healthcare system. The closer you get to a monopoly, the more pricing power that monopoly has. And they use that pricing power.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Brian Alexander, who's an author, writer. His most recent book is called The Hospital, Life, Death, and Dollars in a Small American Town. I really highly recommend this book because it hits on so many current challenges we're facing in our country. So it's, as I said in the opening, it's not just the story of one small rural hospital in northwestern Ohio. It's really the story of a larger economy in our society here in 2021. I want to talk about that a little bit because it just seems like, and you detail this in the book, how the Great Recession back in 2007, 2008 really impacted the region, which of course impacts its healthcare, obviously. But it just, and it just seems like we're still uncovering the impact of that Great Recession, that maybe it wasn't as noticeable at first, but it is now. The movie that won the Academy Award, Nomadland, plays off of the problems coming from the Great Recession regarding people losing their homes. What did you see observing in Williams County on how that was affecting not only the community but also the healthcare system?
Yeah, it's so true. The Great Recession came at the end of 30 years of the hollowing out of parts of the Midwest, the industrial hollowing out of parts of that country, and a lot of these towns. And then the Great Recession was like a gigantic bomb. And the shock waves of that are still reverberating throughout these communities. All you have to do is spend any time at all in the county courthouse. Just go to any county courthouse and sit and watch the people parade through, whether it's family court with divorces, or it's drug court, or it's eviction court. People are still paying the price for what happened. And one of the things that happened in the case of Bryan, Ohio, and Williams County is that the better paying jobs often went away, and they were replaced by poorer paying jobs. So the example in Williams County is right as the recession was at one of its deepest points, a new Menards Distribution Center opened up in Williams County, and a lot of people went there for jobs because at the time, Williams County was experiencing 17.5% unemployment. It was devastating for Williams County. So they got jobs, and they did. It was a big employer. But those jobs now paid, instead of $25 an hour, $26 an hour, people started at that time at $11 an hour. This has happened in many places. Warehouses, distribution centers, really have become big employers throughout rural and small town America, and in small city, former small cities like Lima, Ohio, oftentimes places like Toledo, Ohio, which is slightly larger. So people are working. Unemployment is actually very low there, but they're making a lot less money, and it becomes harder and harder to live, and that has a lot of follow-on effects. It affects how you can grocery shop. It affects how much you can sleep. I profile a woman who works three jobs and felt that she was really lucky if she got 5 hours of sleep a night. That affects your health. But then if something health-related occurs, then you've got to encounter this parallel universe of American healthcare, and it's enormously expensive. So as a result, people don't go to doctors, and then something bad happens. They've delayed their care, and now it's very serious. So this is why poor counties, poorer counties in our country, people die earlier. They live less healthy lives. This is all related to the society we've built and the economy that we've built.
You're referring to one person in the book that works those multiple jobs, and I think that's the same person where you talk about defeat becoming a culture. And she didn't seem resentful. But I thought that was an interesting way of putting it, where it seems like so many people have been beaten down by not having good paying jobs, and then the bad health effects pile on, and they're working maybe multiple jobs, but they can never get ahead. But for some of them, they're not really, I found myself sometimes feeling angry for them, but maybe the defeat is overcoming any feelings like that to overtake them, and it's more of acceptance.
You know, we just had a very good example of this down in Bessemer, Alabama, where they were trying to unionize an Amazon distribution center down there. I was not terribly surprised that the union drive lost that election. because after the election, workers who voted against the union said what I expected them to say. They said, look, Amazon starts us at $15 an hour. And a lot of the other employers around here are paying us $11, $12 an hour. So this is actually a better job. And I don't want to upset the apple cart because, God forbid, I would lose this job or this job would become more difficult. They've, you know, it's a step up. It's still a lousy pay, but it's a step up from really lousy pay. And so they feel lucky to have the job at all. It's my view that there's really been a war on workers in this country for a long time now, almost 40 years. And it has led to the proliferation of low-wage jobs, and people are just happy to have any kind of work.
I think there's something to that. In the book, you talk about how people emerged from it, changed about the foundations of life, and there was a quote, I think, in there that compared with 20 years ago, people are now meaner and lonelier. And I sense that, too, in these areas, that, again, something fundamental has changed from that Great Recession. And I'll repeat it. I think we're just, this book and others are just starting to peel this back a little bit. But do you sense that when you come back to them? Is this a regional thing, or do you sense that a little bit out where you're at in California as well?
I sense it less here. I live in a city. In California, that's pretty prosperous, San Diego. So I sense it less. But you don't have to go too far. Inland California, where there are communities that are struggling, they do have some of this. You know, concurrent with our war on workers, the way I describe it, we also have had an erosion of sense of community. And this is true in many communities. You know, we have forgotten how big a role a lot of our bigger employers in some of these towns, what role they played. It was true in Lancaster, Ohio, where I grew up in the glass businesses there. It was true in Bryan, Ohio. There was a big company in Bryan, Ohio, Aero, A-R-O. They were sort of an engineering maker of fluid handling devices. They made valves and pumps and that sort of thing for the aerospace industry and airlines and automobiles and so on. And they employed over 2,000 people in that small town. And as a result, you have a vibrant community because they, you know, that the stuff that makes a vibrant community can be supported. And that sort of goes away. You know, there have been books. There's a book called Bowling Alone. For example, that details what happened to bowling leagues, what happened to bridge clubs, what happened to service organizations. There still are rotaries and so on in many of these places, but quite often they're diminished. Often the members are much older. And so we go off on our own. We're very family focused. We take the kids to soccer. And we don't really get involved in community so much anymore. We don't see ourselves as community. I think that's true on a small town level, and it's true on a national level, because we're all just struggling to, you know, make a living at the moment.
Yeah, and you talk in the book about the work ethic and how some folks will look down and judge a lot of these people and say they don't want to work, they want to stay home and watch TV or whatever. But you point out how, and I thought it was interesting, because I see this here where I live, that the TV is the only form of entertainment. They can't afford vacations, and the movies cost too much.
Yeah, you know, I heard this. It's funny. I heard this in Lancaster, too. And then when I went up to Bryan, it was actually a real theme. People said it to me over and over and over again. And they would say, well, yeah, these people, you know, they say they're poor, but they've got these giant flat-screen TVs. How can they really be poor and have these giant flat screen TVs? Well, first of all, they're often renting these TVs at an outrageous amount of rental money. It would be much cheaper if they could just buy it. But secondly, finally, a social worker at the hospital, I was relating this to her, and I said, you know, I hear this over and over again throughout the town. And she goes, yeah, everybody says that, but look at it this way. if you were never going to be able to take your family to a movie, you were never going to have a vacation, what do you have? You can watch the TV. So that's the way people cope. You know, somebody else said to me, people say, look, you've got to sacrifice to get the things you want, but somehow it's only the poor people who wind up sacrificing. And I think that's true here in Williams County with the people who populate my book, The Hospital. And it's true where you are. It's true down in southeast Ohio. It's true in Kentucky. It's true many parts of Michigan, Wisconsin. This is happening in many places.
Got time for about one more question here, Brian. I've got about a minute left, but I didn't, by the way, I'm not going to give away what happens to one of the protagonists in the book. I people should buy it and read it. I was surprised, but I just want to ask you, do you think independent small hospitals like this one will be able to survive here in the near future, 5 years, say?
I think that's an open question. The hospital at the heart of the book is still surviving. In fact, just today they announced that they were selected as a top rural hospital in the country, one of the top. So they're still going. I think that ultimately many of our community hospitals will wind up either closing their doors or being absorbed into these large consolidating health systems. And I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. And I think the government should start to get involved with more antitrust cases to take a harder look at some of this consolidation, because it raises prices for everybody.
Well, this is a great book. And again, I thank you for writing it and sharing it. And for our listeners, again, the book is called The Hospital, Life, Death, and Dollars in a Small American Town. If you take the time, go buy it, you'll see the relation to what we're facing, not just in healthcare, but in our economy in this region. And I think it's a very timely topic. And I do appreciate you coming back on, Brian, to share this with us. And I hope that I'll be looking forward to whatever book you tackle next.
I'm working on a couple of ideas, and it's always a pleasure to speak to you. I really appreciate you letting me have a little time on your show. It's always a great experience.
Thank you very much.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org. in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.